Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Situations have ended sad. Relationships have all been bad, sang Bob Dylan. Mine have been like Verlaine's and Rimbaud. And there he was again, the French poet, rebel, bad boy Arthur Rimbaud, a century after the teenage explosion of form-smashing poetry that made him a hero in time to artists from Henry Miller to punk rock. A new biographer by famed novelist and biographer Edmund White brings it all back with a fresh take. This hour, On Point, the rebel poet who was done at 21, Rimbaud. You can join the conversation. Can you quote The Drunken Boat? The lines from Burroughs to Kerouac to Patti Smith and Jim Morrison that bow to Rimbaud. Joining me now from New York is Edmund White, celebrated novelist and biographer. He wrote A Boy's Own Story, lived for years in Paris, won the National Book Critics Circle Award in 1993 for his biography of Jean Genet. His latest novel is Hotel de Dream. His new biography is Rimbaud, The Double Life of a Rebel. Edmund White, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. Thanks very much for being here.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
What is it about this guy who wrote poetry from the time he was 15 to 19 or so, and then for a little further, maybe to 20, 21, then stopped completely? Well, listen with me, if you would, for just a second, Edmund, to Patti Smith, just to get a sense of this. Patti Smith, godmother of punk, we're talking a long time after Rimbaud, cites him as one of her biggest influences. Here she is in a 2004 interview, actually with NPR's Morning Edition, describing her first encounter with this poet in a used bookstore across from a bus station in Philadelphia.
There used to be, I don't know if it's there anymore, but like one of these stores that sell like probably dirty magazines and stuff like that, but they had a bin, you know, for like a quarter or something, you could get these used paperbacks. And I found a book of Illuminations, and the word Illumination, great word, beautiful face of Rimbaud. And I opened it up, and the language in it just totally seduced me, and I fell in love.
Patti Smith, seduced by Rimbaud, Dylan Thomas, Bob Dylan, Jim Morrison, Van Morrison, you know, Burroughs and Henry Miller and Kerouac, you name it. What is it about this poet, Edmund, that's done that?
Well, they sometimes call him the god of adolescence, and I think that is part of the appeal. He was incredibly handsome. He was very dynamic. He was a total rebel from his peasant background in the northeast of France. He came to Paris. He conquered everybody and then pretty soon offended everybody. But he certainly was the opposite of a middle-class person. He didn't care about being conventional. He could be unspeakably rude to people. And the most important thing is that he was a giant of poetry. He was totally original. And his first long poem, The Drunken Boat, really reinvented poetry, I think, for modern times.
Arthur Rimbaud lived from 1854 to 1891, wrote poetry, at least poetry that was published from the time he was 15 until 19, 20, 21, then closed the book on it entirely, walked away from that, was off to the Arabian Peninsula and a lot of time in Africa, never looked back. Did he have any sense in his lifetime, died at 37, that he'd be a kind of James Dean of the world of poetry a century later? Was that at all clear?
I don't think he knew much about it, but to the degree he did know, he rejected it bitterly. He was ashamed of those years when he was a great poet and the demon of Paris. For instance, when he was in North Africa, his boss, he was a gun runner, and his boss was another European called Monsieur Bardet, who said to him, "Oh, I've just read an article in the paper saying that you're the father of symbolism." And Rimbaud just made an angry gesture and said, "Oh, that's nothing but hogwash."
He was in the symbolist school, the decadent school. What was the historical moment in which he came on the scene, sort of?
I think the main thing that was happening at his time was the Franco-Prussian War mm-hmm. and the Commune. The Prussians had invaded France, and they threw out Napoleon III in a series of very sharp, strong battles, and they created a kind of vacuum that meant that Paris sort of elected itself as the first communist regime in the world, in world history. And the Commune of Paris in 1870 was a kind of wild and woolly place where all the middle-class people fled, and what was left were the riffraff, and a lot of other kind of seedy people from all over France came there, including Rimbaud, who was a vagrant. And they all sort of set up shop, and the city was besieged, and there was no food, and people were eating the animals in the zoo. Mm-hmm. It was a really wild time, and it was also, as you might suspect, really fertile in terms of creativity.
An open time in a city that could be pretty open in any case, but this is an especially open time. He was from the Ardennes, up where the Battle of the Bulge would later be fought. Napoleon III had a huge defeat just miles from his home in his youth. So this really was
in
a wide open time.
Yes, that's right. And his town was garrisoned by Prussian troops, and the next little town over was bombed by the Prussians. So he was very aware of this foreign presence, but he was anything but a patriot. He didn't much care who ruled his hometown.
I'm still trying to grasp, though, this 15-year-old putting out poems that were so challenging, so rebellious, and then only progressively more so through his teens. I mean, what kind of person or culture was this who, at that extremely young age, could be sort of doing things in poetry terms which are seen as upending maybe centuries of tradition? Who was he to pull that off?
Well, I mean, obviously he was a remarkable individual, but I think he could never have achieved what he did had they not had such a great school system. I mean, in fact, Rimbaud and Genet, the other French rebel I've written about, they were both peasant boys who rose to tremendous heights. Why? Because the public schools were so good. I mean, you had teachers students at 10, 11, 12 were studying Latin and Greek, not to mention all the other subjects. And Rimbaud won lots of prizes. So did Genet. They both were big prize winners. And even though they had almost nothing going for them in terms of their family background, but they could hook into this brilliant national educational system. The tragedy of the United States is that every little local community controls the schools. That's not the way it should be. It should be controlled by the federal government with the highest possible standards, and teachers should be sent out from the capital or from other places. In France, you were never allowed to serve in the same district where you had grown up. So it was a very uniform and uniformly excellent system that produced these little geniuses.
But it hardly made him, as you say, a would-be patriot or a great candidate for the Chamber of Commerce. You've got a section there from a poem called Seven-Year-Old Poets by Rimbaud. Could you read that bit for us?
Sure. And the mother, closing the exercise book, went away satisfied and very proud, without noticing in his blue eyes and on his forehead, so prominent with genius, the child's soul giving into revulsion. All day long he sweats with obedience, very intelligent. However, certain fidgets and looks seem to prove he's guilty of being a nasty hypocrite. In the dark corridors with their mildewed curtains, he sticks out his tongue as he walks by, plants both fists against his groin, and squeezes his eyes shut till he sees stars.
the young rebel in readiness or preparation there. I mean, he burst on the scene ready to upturn and reject. I don't want to get too Freudian here, but is it clear from his childhood why he was set up in that particular outrageous path to norms of that time?
Well, his mother was extremely strict even for the times, and she would go to church every Sunday in her Sunday best, followed by her two daughters and her two sons, all like little ducklings following the mother duck. And they were not allowed to look either to the right or to the left, and they weren't really supposed to play with any other children. And they were very disciplined. The father was a kind of a rake and a soldier who would show up just long enough to get his wife pregnant and then leave again. And after five pregnancies in 6 years, he vanished for good and no one ever saw him again. So the mother, who was a very Catholic, very pious and strict woman, was left with raising these children without that much money. And so I think Rambeau had a super conformist childhood, and then he rebelled in the most extraordinary fashion against all that.
Mm. Reaching out to the great poets, the prominent poets of the time in Paris, trying to get someone to kind of extend a hand and pull him in. He ultimately found that in Verlaine. We'll talk about the note that came back from the older poet to the young aspiring poet saying, "Come, dear great soul, we await you, we desire you." And maybe literally their great illicit love affair, the source of all kinds of controversy at the time and still making waves a century and more later. Edmund White is with us, the great novelist, critic, and biographer. He's got a new biography, Rambeau, The Double Life of a Rebel. Bob Dylan referenced the love affair between Rambeau and Paul Verlaine in his song, "You're Gonna Make Me Lonesome When You Go," from Blood on the Tracks in 1975. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Blue River running slow and lazy. I could stay with you forever and never realize the time. Situations have ended sad, relationships have all been bad. Mine have been like Verlaine's and Rambeau. But there's no way I can compare all them scenes to this affair. You're gonna make me lonesome when you go.
We're talking this hour about wild boy, poet, and adventurer Arthur Rambeau and his imprint from 19th century France to the beat poets Bob Dylan, Jim Morrison, Patti Smith. And right now, Edmund White is with us, novelist, critic, biographer. His new biography is Rambeau, The Double Life of a Rebel. Edmund White joins us from New York. It's very, the poetry, I mean, he sort of goes to prose poems and free verse, a real pioneer in both of those, but there's a great vividness and vitality all the way through, even before he starts breaking crockery quite so much. There's one poem called Sensation from Arthur Rambeau. I wonder if you could read for us, Edmund.
Sure. On a blue summer evening, I shall go down the path and, brushed by wheat, walk on the fine grass. Dreaming along, I'll feel the coolness under my feet and bathe my bare head in the poetic wind. I won't speak. I will not even think. But infinite love will geyser up in my soul, and I'll go far, far away, like a gypsy into the wilds, as happy as if I were with a woman.
Rambeau's Sensation. He hardly sounds like a firebrand poet, rebel breaking the crockery there. It still seems part of the kind of romantic tradition. He must have had some quick evolution once he started putting pen to paper.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I think one of the things that happened was he started reading a lot of boys' magazines about adventures, about especially in, you know, the kind of Jules Verne stories about traveling to the North Pole or meeting all kinds of monsters in the middle of the ocean. That was the kind of thing he loved to read as a kid. And he had the sort of inspiration, and that was quite original, to incorporate that material into poetry. He obviously could write conventional poetry very beautifully, and he was highly influenced by Victor Hugo and Baudelaire. Both of those were two of the formative influences on him. He also, as I mentioned earlier, knew Latin very well, and he wrote 100 verses in Latin to the Prince Imperial, to Napoleon III's son, and received a comment from the Royal Palace. He was very, very accomplished as a conventional and traditional stylist. But all of a sudden, he realized he could introduce this weird and wild subject matter into his poetry. And later, he incorporated his amorous adventures with Verlaine into his poetry in such things as as Illuminations and Season in Hell.
We'll hear it. Victor Hugo, of course, called him the infant Shakespeare. Baudelaire, kind of his bad boy predecessor. I was talking with my French-born father-in-law, the incomparable Robert Guichard about Rimbaud the other night. And he said growing up being educated in Paris in the 30s and 40s, Rimbaud was mentioned, but only just. He was in a Catholic school. This is not a poet that the brothers, the priests, were celebrating in his formal French education in the 20th century.
I'm sure that's right. But nevertheless, Paul Claudel, who was one of the most respected Catholic writers, decided fairly early on, like around 1905, between 1905 and 10, that Rimbaud was a great saint, was a Catholic poet. I mean, one of the most extraordinary things about Rimbaud is how widely and variously he's been interpreted.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some people see him as a kind of proto-surrealist, and other people see him as a punk, as you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Other people see him as a neoclassical poet like Victor Hugo or like or like Baudelaire. And yet other people see him as a great gay poet. Mm-hmm. And some people see him as a Catholic saint. His own sister did everything she could as soon as he died to launch his saintly reputation. And Claudel, who was a great playwright and poet and the ambassador from France to China and various other countries, Claudel claimed that he was converted to Catholicism by reading Season in Hell.
We'll hear more. I want to begin to turn to our listeners, if I may. Edmund White is with us from New York. His new biography is Rimbaud, The Double Life of a Rebel, from La Belle, Florida. We're joined by Julie. Hi, Julie. You're on the air with Edmund White.
Hi, both
Hi.
Of you.
Hi.
I actually just feel very ignorant. I'm a big fan of Bob Dylan and The Doors, and, you know, I come from that time.
Yep.
And I never heard of this guy. So I want to read, and I want to know where to start.
If you love Bob Dylan and The Doors, you're probably going to love Rimbaud. What do you say, Edmund?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there are several translations of his poetry that are available. First of all, we should say how his name is spelled, R-I-M-B-A-U-D, Rimbaud.
Mm-hmm.
And because some people think we're talking about the
Sylvester
superhero.
Stallone. Right?
Sylvester Stallone. It does sound sort of similar. Anyway, you can. I mean, there are at least half a dozen cheap paperback editions of his poetry, and it's a lot of fun to read.
Would you point, Julie, to a sort of way in here if she wants to dive in and begin to see the thread from Rimbaud to Bob Dylan and The Doors? What poem might you point to?
Well, I think there's a long poem called The Drunken Boat, and it's a wild and woolly voyage through all the various, through the North Pole, the South Pole, past all the monsters, inner and outer. And, I mean, it's at once a sort of psychological poem about the inner journey of into the soul and a kind of external journey into some of the more extreme places in nature.
It really is one of those adventure boy stories, The Drunken Boat, where, as you write, I mean, it starts with, he says, while swept downstream on indifferent rivers, I felt the boatman's tow ropes slacken. Yawping redskins took them as targets, nailing them naked to totem poles. And soon the boat is on its own. The boat is kind of narrating, going with the flow. You've got a couple of excerpts from Rimbaud's The Drunken Boat. Could you read for us?
Sure. Let me just...
He goes
look.
Past, the Leviathan, and as you say, the Arctic, and wild flowers of Florida, and Europe's ancient parapets, you right. have him here.
Right. And then it says, and from then on I was bathed in the poem of the sea, which was steeped in stars and turning milky white, absorbing the green blues. In the sea, a pensive drowned man, bloated, livid, and enraptured, sometimes sank past me. And in another part he says, but it's true I've wept too long. Dawns are heartbreaking. Every moon is ghastly, and every sun bitter. Acrid love has pumped me full of intoxicating drowsiness. Oh, may my keel explode. Oh, let me sink at sea. And then he ends, how vast the world is by the light of lamps. To the eyes of memory, how the world is small.
Julie, can you hear a little Bob Dylan running through there a century later? Does it sound like you could put it to Dylan tune?
I'd like to read more, that's for sure. I'd really like to read more. And it's just like, wow, you know, not know this. You know, like a lot of times you catch things in song verses that relate to other things I have read, like the Led Zeppelin, I think, did The Hobbit. And, you know, this is, like, new to me.
So. A lot of history stands behind what makes us tap our foot or dream. Let's get a call from Margaret in Belmont, Massachusetts. Margaret, you're on the air.
I'm very interested in Rimbaud and translated some letters many years ago at college. And I was very taken with one statement that he made in one of his letters, and I don't know who it was, too, and it was je et un autre, I, and I is another. And I thought it was, he used the grammar incorrectly.
Yes.
Instead of I am another, he said I is another.
Very deliberately and very famously in this phrase.
Yes, and I thought it revealed very much the dichotomy within himself and with the outside world, and it practically had a sort of Eastern, even a, not religious, but an Eastern sense of the I trying to be something else than what it was born into. And I'd very much like the author to comment on that if he has
central
interest.
To Rimbaud. Wonderful. I is another. Maybe central to the subtitle of your book as well, Edmund White, The Double Life of a Rebel.
Well, the phrase is from a letter to his teacher, Georges Isambard. Mm. And Isambard was a wonderful sort of teacher for Rimbaud to have had because he was a young man, only a few years older than his own students, who loved poetry. And in this rather dismal little town of Charleville, where Rimbaud lived, there were very few books, and certainly very few contemporary books. I mean, contemporary poetry wasn't really in every library in those days. And so Rimbaud was lucky to find this teacher who had an extensive library, who would lend him books, and who would encourage him to write. And in one of his letters, after he had experienced Paris and even been arrested for having an improper train ticket and put in prison for a few days. Mm. And his teacher sprang him, and he and Rimbaud then wrote him this famous letter called the Letter of the Seer, the Lettre d'un Voyant.
S-E-E-R.
S-E-E-R, mm-hmm. Right. Because he saw himself as a kind of visionary. Mm-hmm. And part of that vision, as our caller quite accurately puts it, is that he had this sort of alienated sense of himself, that there is an I, but the I isn't really integrated into any immediate sense of the self. It's an object that is out there to be studied as any other subject might be.
And he did. And he wanted to kind of push all the boundaries, even the sense of himself, maybe to pursue that seer role. He talks about reaching for poetic transcendence through, quoting him, a long, intimidating, immense, and rational derangement of all the senses. That sounded for all the world to me like rockers in the 1960s, sort of, you know, strung out on everything, looking to kind of get beyond the normal, the bourgeoisie's habits, the world, the conventional world.
Well, Rimbaud was a big drinker of absinthe. And that apparently had a very strong effect on him. And then later, he did do a lot of hashish. And so I think he really, and of course, this was a fairly established tradition by this point, because Baudelaire had said, you should be drunk, you know, enivrez-vous. Mm. And this idea that you should always be high and that you should try to look at the world in an entirely different way, having disordered your senses, I think that's an idea that certainly appealed to the Beats and the punks later.
Let's get a call from Susan in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Susan, you're on the air.
Yeah. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
It's Susan Wohl, David Levitt's
oh,
friend.
Yes. Wonderful. Hi, Susan.
Yeah. Hi. And hi, Ed.
Hi, Susie.
Yeah. Hi. How are you?
Good.
I went to college with Ed, and he's actually the guy who introduced me to the underground life of gay people.
Yes.
In the United States.
You and many others.
That's right. He then wrote about it.
Yeah.
But I had a kind of upfront And I had the early version.
Yes.
And life was very hard at that time for people who were living against the context of the culture.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wonder what was the, if Ed could put in context for us, and this is a hard one, Ed, what was Rambeau's relationship or Verlaine, his to society? I mean, the drugs, the sexual life, the poetry, versus the 60s, and now in how you see it presently with Prop 8 and all the advances.
That is a big question. Well, I mean, certainly Rambeau went very, very far in his wildness, even for his bohemian contemporaries. I mean, the poets were very happy to welcome him. They were astonished by the beauty of the drunken boat, which he brought with him from his village to Paris.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of a 16-year-old having written this sumptuous, long, and totally revolutionary poem absolutely knocked everybody over. But he very soon alienated almost everyone because people would put him up in their spare room, and before you knew it, he would be standing naked in the window, or he would be urinating out the window, or he would be burning their crucifix, or he would be selling all their furniture. I mean, he really was
thanks
an extreme.
A lot. Yeah, house guest.
Yeah, he was the house guest from hell.
Right.
So,
and he and Verlaine were very out with their torrid gay relationship in Paris when this was just way beyond the pale.
I mean, they were the most famous gay couple of the 19th century before before Oscar Wilde and Lord Alfred Douglas. But, I mean, there was nothing quite like that anybody had ever seen. And to be so open and so public about it. But I think they both paid tremendous price for it. Verlaine's marriage came to a terrible end.
Mm-hmm.
He sank into alcoholism. He was imprisoned. Rambeau was, I think, sort of driven mad by it and finally reacted to that whole life with such total revulsion that he never wrote another word and never wanted to hear about that part of his life. If you compare that, as Susie was suggesting, to the 60s, I think that it was interesting that the lefties in the 60s, like the bohemians in the 1870s, were very wild and woolly, but they didn't like homosexuality. Nobody much liked homosexuality.
Mm. Mm.
And, I mean, it was oftentimes the last taboo. And I think that, for instance, Allen Ginsberg was terribly popular in the 60s, but he wasn't... It seems sort of remarkable that he was able to get away with being as gay as he was.
Yeah.
And I certainly think that's the side of him that was the least popular or the least well understood back then.
But here we have Rambeau and Verlaine with it right up front for a time and then turning away also famously and powerfully. Susan, thanks very much for calling. It's good to hear your voice. Edmund White is with us from New York, novelist, critic, biographer. His new biography is Rambeau, The Double Life of a Rebel. Punk queen Patti Smith calls Rambeau one of her biggest influences. In her song Land from her 1975 debut album Horses, she gives her favorite poet a shout-out. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about wild boy, poet and adventurer Arthur Rambeau and his imprint from 19th century France to the beat poets Bob Dylan, Jim Morrison, Patti Smith. And right now, Edmund White is with us. He's author of the new biography, Rambeau, The Double Life of a Rebel. Let's get a call from Danny in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Danny, you're on the air with Edmund White.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. What do you know?
I'm doing well. My question is for the author to speak a little bit more about Rambeau's time in Ethiopia. I'm an Ethiopian-American and visited Ethiopia a couple of years ago and had a chance to go to Harar, which is a remote place in Africa and even within Ethiopia.
Yes.
And, you know, Rambeau, I visited Rambeau's house, and it's a very beautiful place. And so my impression from this conversation is that Rambeau went there and really, like, escaped from his life as a poet. So I'm wondering, you know, to hear the author's comments about, you know, what it was like for Rambeau to remove himself from, you know, his life of, you know, being an openly gay man in Paris and experimenting with drugs and alcohol. It seems like, you know, that place in Africa and Ethiopia is like a really interesting part of the story.
Yes, indeed. Danny, let us pick it up. That is a long journey indeed and leaving a lot behind. Edmund White, describe that for us, the move out of his poet life in Paris at, what, 21 or so and off, and not first to Ethiopia, but ultimately and quite colorfully so.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, he kicked around Europe for a few years after he gave up poetry, and he worked in circuses, and he did. He worked in a mine in Cyprus. He did all kinds of various things.
Was in Java for a while, wasn't he?
Java, that's right.
Joined the Dutch army and was set off and deserted.
And he deserted, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Aden, the Arabian Peninsula before Ethiopia?
Absolutely. And he was in Aden. And then eventually he got to Ethiopia, and he was a gunrunner primarily, but a trader in general. He traded all kinds of things.
Coffee.
And he had dealings with with Memelek, who was the ruler of Ethiopia at that time. And he had always wanted to live elsewhere, and even in A Season in Hell, he writes quite a bit about wanting to wake up on foreign shores, to become completely bronzed from the sun, to smoke cigarettes, to drink strong liquors. But what's interesting is that he actually became fairly puritanical when he lived in North Africa. He doesn't seem to have continued being homosexual, and the only sexual partner we know about, or romantic partner, was a very beautiful Ethiopian woman who was photographed with him and who lived with him for a while. Mm. And he was fairly good to her and gave her a large dowry when they split up. He did have an African slave boy that he left some money to in his will, not a slave boy, but a servant. He wanted to buy a slave, but another European said to him, no, that really wasn't on. You Europeans weren't supposed to have slaves.
And as Danny says, this city, Harar, was so remote. I mean, you describe it as 500 miles from the coast, of course, then and now. But then a 20-day camel caravan ride across the desert to get there.
That's right. No, it was extremely remote. And, of course, it was a Muslim town, and it was a walled city surrounded by jackals. So you didn't want to go straying out there on a moonlit evening. You couldn't have conceived of a place that was more foreign or remote. And Rambeau, in the later part of his life, is one of the great complainers. He just writes endless letters to his mother complaining about the difficulty of his life. But on the other hand, it's one that he chose over and over again. His mother wanted him to come home. He had saved some money. He could have come home. But he just kept living there. And also, he was fascinated by being an explorer. And even though he'd given up writing poetry, he did write a few things which were articles for geographic magazines about areas where no white man had ever been before. And he would describe these routes and the landscape, I mean, these almost lunar landscapes that he was encountering. And he studied Arabic. He studied Amharic. He knew several Ethiopian languages. And he was a good linguist, and he was a serious person, of course, and a very brilliant one.
And all this making him only the more exotic to everyone who would follow after his teenage explosion of poetry. You write about him as the exalted revolutionary who thought poetry must break with tradition and usher in a whole new era of human history. Poetry ushering in a new era of human history. How literally did he think that, mean that?
I think he did quite literally believe in it. He was a someone who loved to read about alchemy, the medieval science of turning base metals into gold, and he or the philosopher's stone that would gain the adept immortal life. And I think he was fascinated by this, and he felt that poetry could have these kind of alchemical powers that would transform the world. And I think one reason he stopped writing is when he realized that poetry could not do that. And he wasn't content to be a famous poet or a widely respected literary man. That was not at all what he was interested in. He was interested in changing the world. And when it didn't change, he was ready to move on to something else.
There was very tough poetry. The Tortured Heart, interpreted in many ways, but at least by one interpretation, he had arrived in Paris as a teenager, and at least one historian imagines or reports him raped by soldiers in Paris. Introduce us to this poem and perhaps read it for us.
Yeah, I mean, as you say, this poem is quite controversial. And Rimbaud's first biographer in English, Enid Starkey, who was an Oxford don, she had this idea that this poem proved that he'd been raped by soldiers during the Paris Commune. But I think that's highly dubious. But obviously, there is some deep feeling of revulsion and violation at the heart of this poem.
The Tortured Heart.
My sad heart drools on the prow. My heart soaked in tobacco spit. They spit streams of liquid. My sad heart drools on the prow. Fully erect and terribly martial, their insults have degraded it. Along the tiller, you see painted frescoes, fully erect and terribly martial. Oh, waves chanting magic spells, take my heart and let it be washed clean. Fully erect and terribly martial, their insults have degraded it. When they'll have spit out their tobacco, what will you do then, O stolen heart? There will be Dionysian hiccups when they'll have spit out their tobacco. My stomach will be turning over, even if I swallow. My nausea, when they will have spit out their tobacco, what will you do then, O stolen heart?
The Tortured Heart from Rimbaud, I mean, breaking old forms and feeling the revulsion all at the same time, very vividly there. Gabrielle in Plymouth, Massachusetts, you're on the air with Edmund White.
Hello, Tom.
Hello.
I wanted to go back to what you said about his one and only book when he was 16 years old. There is a parallel with Saint Thérèse of Lisieux, who herself wrote a one and only book, a monument for the Catholics, when she was 16. I think the two most important and striking things about these two books are that they are written by innocents, by young people.
Mm-hmm.
They are absolutely truthful, and they spill out. Nature is untouched and unsoiled by modern or by conventions or by learned things. And I thought it was a nice comparative to make when you mentioned the sainthood of Arthur Rimbaud.
Thank you, Gabrielle. Edmund?
Oh, that's a fascinating parallel, and not one I've thought of. I mean, I know that Saint Thérèse de Lisieux was terribly important to the French at this time. I mean, she's a little bit later than Rimbaud, but it was in 1905 when the church and the state were divided finally, and they were no longer allowed to be the same institution, and the Vatican sort of rushed Saint Thérèse into sainthood as a kind of consolation prize for French Catholics so they could have their very own modern saint. And she was somebody who had this very pure and ardent vision, which you could compare to Rimbaud.
Gabrielle, thank you very much for calling. Let's take one from Williamsburg, Virginia. And Brett, you're on the air with Edmund White.
Yes, hello, Tom. You have a great show. I'm interested in Mr. White talking about Rimbaud's influence on the sort of glorification of youth as kind of an unsustainable poetic vision. We have Hart Crane, who's maybe the most direct inheritor of it in our heritage. But at the same time, and this is sort of a second stage of what I'm liking to comment on, we have Walt Whitman, who in a similar period makes a similar breaking up of the ice, but then manages to evolve his poetic vision into one that accommodates the wisdom of age. I wonder if you could comment on this.
Evan White.
I think that's absolutely fascinating comparison. I mean, Whitman is interesting because he never came out. I mean, that is, when people from Europe would come to visit him, including Oscar Wilde, and praise him for being openly homosexual, he would look horrified and deny that he was homosexual. Mm. And yet, he wrote these poems, the Calamus poems, which include some of the most beautiful homosexual poetry ever written. And so he obviously, the love of comrades is a terribly important part of his poetry. And he, and like Rambo, he indulged in free verse. Like Rambo, he must have been very influenced by the Bible and by these long biblical cadences. But as the caller suggests, Whitman was somebody who lived on to become a very old man and became a kind of national poet, and who wrote a great series of poems to the dead Abraham Lincoln. So he was able to subsume his own experience, and especially his homosexual experience, into a large national vision of love and adhesiveness, connecting men and women to each other throughout the nation. He was a great democratic poet. This was very different from Rambo, who probably had not even the tiniest political bone in his body, and who really didn't live long enough to be interested in society. He was more interested in his own private hell and heaven.
Let's go to Jackson Hole, Wyoming, and Eve. Eve, you're on the air with Edmund White.
Hi, Tom. Yeah, I'm calling because I couldn't help laughing about earlier on when you guys were referring to the French education system. And to Rambo's credit, that he was a genius and creative is no thanks to the normal French education system, which I'm a product of. The system was created by Napoleon to make military officers, and it's very rigid. The only good thing about it, as you mentioned, is that it's a national program, so you know that somebody in Nîmes or Paris or some age are learning about the same thing. But as far as creativity, it's a very rigid thing. And all you do for from 6 to 18 years old is learn a lot of facts. And if you any, actually, creativity is kind of frowned upon, and I remember the having some bad mark in French dissertation for, you know, what I thought being thinking outside the envelope.
Right, for being creative, and you got whacked for it. Eve, thanks for that observation. Our time is so short. Edmund, can you read one more bit for us from the Illuminations, Genie? Our time is short. Can you plunge straight in? He gets into free verse here, prose poetry.
He is affection and exists in the present, since he has declared open house to foamy winter and the sound of summer. He who has purified drinks and foods, he who is the spell cast over elusive places and is the superhuman pleasure attached to those sights that are stationary. He is affection and the future, the strength and love that we, mired in our fury and boredom, see rush overhead in an angry tempest through flags of ecstasy. He is love, cut to a perfect and reinvented size. He is reason, miraculous and unforeseen, and he is eternity, a beloved machine of fatal attractions. We have all been terrified by his concessions, his and ours. Oh, the pleasure of our health, the play of our faculties, our self-serving affection and passion for him. He who will love us down through the long years of his infinite life.
From Rambo's Illuminations, he who stopped writing at 21 and was dead at 37. but an inspiration to you. You write all the way back in the 50s, you know, as a teenager yourself, reading this, dreaming into the kind of exotic climes that Rimbaud described, a real influence on you, among others, Edmund.
Yes, yes, he was definitely a hero for me, because he represents somebody who threw over his family and his school and rushed off to Paris, as I longed to rush off to New York, and embrace a life of sex, adventure, getting high, and writing great pages.
There's the epitaph almost for Rimbaud. Edmund White's new biography is Rimbaud, The Double Life of a Rebel. We're very grateful to you for sharing this hour with us, Edmund. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks, Tom. It's a pleasure.
Wonderful to have you. Listeners, you can learn more at our website, onpointradio.org. We'll go out with Bob Dylan's song, Just Like Tom Thumb's Blues, from Highway 61 Revisited. Gets its title from Rimbaud's poem, My Bohemian Life, in which the poet refers to himself as Tom Thumb in a daze. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Stuff. Everybody said they'd stand behind.